This is Writer's Voice. Today, two books, both with roots in South Asia and America, touching on two of the most central issues of our time, climate and immigration. We talk first with acclaimed novelist and writer Amitav Ghosh about his newest work of fiction, Gun Island. Then NPR correspondent Aarti Shahani tells us about her stunning family memoir of immigration to America, The Dream and the Nightmare. It's called Here We Are. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. Amitav Ghosh has a long raft of books behind him, mostly fiction, dealing with a multiplicity of themes. But his last two books reveal a preoccupation with climate change. His 2016 book, The Great Derangement, is subtitled Climate Change and the Unthinkable. It explores how fiction should deal with this existential crisis facing us all. His new book, Gun Island, does just that. A beautifully realized novel, Gun Island spans space and time, science and legend, to tell the story of a world on the brink. But it's also a story of hope, of a man whose faith in the world and the future is restored by two remarkable women. Amitav Ghosh is the author of, among many other books, the Ibis Trilogy, of which the novel Sea of Poppies was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. Amitav Ghosh, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
This wonderful novel, Gun Island, is a kind of allegory rooted in the catastrophes that are unfolding around us, the linked crises of climate, refugees, and inequality. You said in an interview with NPR that the world of fact is outrunning the world of fiction. Tell us why you said that.
Well, that was in particular reference to some of the events I write about in the book. You remember that there's a scene that's set in Los Angeles. It's of a wildfire advancing on a museum that's quite like the Getty Museum. Mm-hmm. And as you may remember, something like that did actually happen in 2017. But the strange thing was that I actually wrote that chapter before that wildfire happened, in fact. So, you know, it was a strange thing watching it play out. It was like watching something unfolding that you had imagined and watching it become real. It was kind of horrifying and, gripping at the same time.
And very much this kind of play between fiction and reality and using fantasy in some ways, because there are elements of magical realism in your book to describe the reality that is bearing down upon us. You also wrote a book called The Great Derangement, which is about difficulty in fiction of being able to look at the reality around us. Talk a little bit about your evolution toward grappling with this existential crisis and the accompanying crises that we face?
Well, I would say that really we are in a time, not just of climate change, but as Margaret Atwood has said, it's a time of everything change. And what that really means is that, you know, all our practices will have to change. And these are not just practices of, recycling or using different light bulbs or whatever, but also the ways in which we think, the ways in which we think in relation to the earth, in relation to our environment, but also how we think about our work and how we tell stories, how we narrate. You use the phrase magic realism. I don't think that's the phrase that I would use in relation to the evolution of my own thinking and my own ways of storytelling. But quite recently, someone used a phrase which struck me as quite relevant, and the phrase was uncanny realism. And I think that sort of reverberates with me, because I think one of the things that we are seeing around us is the sort of manifestations of the uncanny. I just gave you an example of, what happened in Los Angeles. And that's really a case to point. I mean, what we are seeing are these strange, uncanny events unfolding around us and enveloping us in these uncanny ways. So I did feel when I was writing this book that, you know, this is a territory that I have to enter and that I have to claim and inhabit, if you like.
But also the book is rooted in a legend, a Bengali legend. It's about an Indian-born, Brooklyn-based seller of antiquarian books, Dr. Dean Datta, a man who stumbles on a story that reminds him remarkably of this legend, this Bengali legend. So there is a connection. Yeah, I connect with what you're saying about the uncanny realism, but it's one that also brings us back to the uncanny fiction of legends.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, this particular legend, it really exists. It's a legend about the goddess of snakes and her antagonist, who is a merchant, and she persecutes the merchant because she wants him to be her disciple, and he's very resistant to that idea. Well, it's a legend that I heard a lot as a child growing up in Bengal. And a few years ago, I started rereading the actual epics that tell this legend. And it was a strange thing. I mean, they're very old, you know, these epics. They go back to the 14th, 15th centuries. But as I was reading them, it struck me that they may be legends. They may be in some ways fantastical. But the picture they present of life in Bengal is in many ways more realistic and more accurate for today than, you know, novels about the same subjects.
Could you give us an example of that?
These legends are, for example, a lot of them, they're about disasters, catastrophes, droughts, famines, storms, great waves that sweep in from the sea. And of course, they're about animals, about snakes, and, you know, the ways in which snakes affect people's lives. And I keep noticing nowadays that one of the effects of climate change in the United States is a huge increase in snake bites, especially in places like North Carolina and Georgia. Many more snakes have come into those areas because the climate has changed.
Wow, that's so interesting. Yeah, and it does, but it also seems to me that reality often does take on a legendary cast these times. I think, for example, of Greta Thunberg, who is the climate activist who's 16 but looks as if she's 11, looks like a child, speaks with an incredible power of what is coming and of her generation. And she almost seems to be a legendary figure, a figure that, you know, the world conjures up at this time of our need.
You know, it's so interesting that you mention Greta Thunberg. I mean, I've followed her, everything that she's doing for a long time, and I think she's a fascinating figure and an incredibly brave and effective campaigner and activist. And yes, you know, she does have many sort of legendary elements about her. The figure who's often cited in relation to her is Joan of Arc. But, you know, curiously, she comes, I believe, from one of the most famous families of climate scientists. Apparently, her great-great-grandfather was Svante Arrhenius, who did the first calculations on greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So it's a kind of mysterious conjunction of, if you like, science and legend and family and activism.
Yeah, exactly. And your book, Gun Island, swims in the same kind of environment where legend, reality, past and present really inform each other. Talking about past and present, it's also about the ties that bind us to our past and the reiterations of history. So talk a little bit about, well, tell us a little bit about the plot now, enough to get us started without giving anything away, and the connections between the 17th century, also a time of climate change, and our own.
One of the things that I learned really from writing The Great Derangement was that I think it's impossible to write about climate change in the ways in which we used to write novels. You know, novels were always set within a very delimited time period. Novels didn't range over vast sweeps of time, if you like. But I think simply because climate change is a phenomenon that is, encompasses vast durations of time, that in a way, when we write about these issues, or when we try to write about these events in fiction, we have to find ways of incorporating huge durations of time. So, yes, my book does sort of range over 3 centuries, if you like, or actually it's 4 centuries. 5, in fact, going back to the 16th and the 17th centuries, which were another period of great climate disruption, sometimes spoken of as the Little Ice Age. And, it's a curious thing that actually so many of our legends and so many of our monuments were actually built in the 17th century. So you asked me to talk about the plot of my book. Well, the plot really is the protagonist, Dean Dutta, a very middle-aged man who has spent his life, working as a rare book dealer. He's kind of a retiring kind of person. He lives in Brooklyn. He doesn't venture out very much. He's always led a very quiet life. But, he goes back every now and again to his birthplace, Calcutta. And on one such visit to Calcutta, he hears about a temple in the jungle. And the temple is to a figure that he had once studied, that is a figure called the Merchant. So he goes off to explore this temple. And while exploring it, he has encounters with a couple of local boys who sort of take him to the temple to guide him there. And they have this kind of really shocking encounter with a king cobra, a big snake. And after that, he's kind of traumatized, and he comes back to Brooklyn. But then a strange series of events sort of beset him. And he finds that slowly he's kind of losing control of his own life. He's losing, as it were, his sense of agency and is being taken over by these other forces that he can't identify or control. But he finds increasingly this feeling of being possessed by something. And so he ends up, he lives through all these various kinds of happenings that finally set him on a path to Italy, which is where half the book is set, the last part of the book is set.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Amitav Ghosh about his latest novel, Gun Island. Yeah, this was such an interesting idea in the book about possession. You talk about possession as the loss of connection to the natural world. In other words, he's possessed, but what he's really, I think one other character says, in fact, he's freeing himself from the possession by becoming aware now of our connection to the natural world. And that, in fact, we live in a kind of bizarre enchantment in which we think in this society, in our global society, that we're separate from the natural world and that that's the real possession. So talk a little bit more about that.
This idea of being free of the natural world, of a humanity that's completely independent of, nature, is an idea that really takes shape in the Enlightenment, in the 17th century, in the Little Ice Age, or perhaps because the Little Ice Age was very hard for people to endure. But this idea of gaining complete mastery over nature, of completely separating yourself from nature, that's one of the central themes of the Enlightenment and the sort of technological culture that has followed. The really bizarre thing about it is that it's just so completely delusional.
Well, the very idea of growth, as Greta Thunberg said, this fantasy of endless growth is completely unmoored from reality. And the more we believe in it, the less control we have over our lives.
That is absolutely true. I mean, this whole idea of continuous growth, of always growing, of expanding endlessly, it's a crazy idea. But again, it's important to note that this idea really comes into being in the 17th century, and it comes into being largely because of the European encounter with the Americas, because they arrived in the Americas. What happened next was this incredible sort of mega death event where, 95% of the indigenous populations died. But in the wake of that, the European settlers had this idea that the earth was endless, it was boundless, it was inexhaustible, it would always provide.
And very much also now, you talk about the 17th century, it was a time of colonialism, the creation of the chattel slave trade, which also features in your book in its modern echoes of the refugee crisis, which of course is also linked to climate change, but also to the predations of the crazy system of economics that we live under. So talk a little bit about how the refugee crisis plays a central role in this book, in Gun Island.
We all know that, there's going to be a massive dislocation because of climate change. People are going to be dislocated from the coasts. They're going to be dislocated from vast tracts of land where people can no longer live simply because the climate is changing in ways that make it impossible for people to live their accustomed lives. We see this happening in America. In fact, already, there is a large relocation and dislocation going on inside America. Inside, for example, California, people are leaving certain areas that are very wildfire-prone and drought-prone and so on. So yes, there will be, we all know that, there will be these massive dislocations. And my interest in this really began a few years ago when I began to notice that there were lots of people from South Asia who were crossing the Mediterranean into Europe. Now, this is an aspect of the European refugee crisis of 2016-2017 that's very rarely spoken of. We always speak of the Middle Eastern and the Sub-Saharan people who were crossing the Mediterranean. But in fact, among them, there were also very large numbers of South Asians. So in 2016 and 2017, I spent a lot of time in Italy, traveling to refugee camps and to migrant centers, to interview refugees and migrants, just to see, what was going on with their lives, what was happening. And yes, it's certainly the case that many of their lives had been completely disrupted by climate change.
And in this book, it does center in Italy. I mean, there's a marvelous scene in the book where a boat that is crossing to Italy. Well, why don't you tell us what this boat is about? And what meets it, both the forces that meet it that are of a benevolent kind and of a malevolent kind?
Well, then again, you have one of the uncanny aspects of this book, which is that, the events that I recount are fictional, but in fact, stuff has been happening, which really is very reminiscent of the book. Okay, so let me just say that, I don't want to give away too much of what happens in the book, but the last parts of it have to do with, with a refugee boat that is heading towards Italy, and it's being banned from entering Italy, which is something that's been happening more and more in recent years. So it's being banned from approaching Italy. But a number of organizations who support refugees have sent out a flotilla to meet the boat. And at the same time, a number of right-wing organizations who are very opposed to migration have also sent out a flotilla, to stop the boat. So a sort of crisis develops around these contrary impulses. And I'm sure if you've been following the news from Europe, you'll know that, events like these have been occurring. There have been lots of young Europeans who really risked their lives, to save these migrants and to, bring them to safety. And at the same time, there have been lots of right-wing Europeans who've been equally committed to stopping them.
And you make a point about the resentment of the refugees by Europeans. And yes, of course, there are those who have mobilized to support them, activists who have mobilized to support them. But I found this a really interesting point that, Europe had conducted the old slave trade in which Europe exported people around the world. I mean, completely changed the human map of the planet. And now those colonial people are coming to Europe. talk a little bit about this resentment, what underlies it by the Europeans, and what you talk about in this book, Amitav Ghosh, in Gun Island.
I think that's one thing we have to remember when we look back on history. I mean, again, really in the 17th century, Europeans began these massive demographic interventions. Of course, it begins before the 17th century. It begins in the 16th century when they conquer, the Americas and Australia and so on. But remember, the first demographic intervention, in a way, is the death of millions and millions of indigenous peoples in the Americas. And this event, I mean, this sort of mass death, mass mortality event that occurs in the Americas is said to have been on such a scale that it actually triggered, at least contributed to the Little Ice Age of the 17th century. Because what happened is that so many people died that vast tracts of land actually reverted to forest. So there was a kind of reverse greenhouse gas effect, which sucked a lot of carbon dioxide out of the air. I mean, that's really why to this day, archaeologists continue to find temples in the jungle, in Mexico and Central America and South America. In fact, those areas were once populated. They had huge populations. They supported huge populations who died, after the Europeans arrived in the Americas. Some of them were directly killed or massacred. But most of them died, through these what you might call biopolitical events, which is, disease and changing of the atmosphere. And along with that, there were these other massive demographic interventions, transporting millions of slaves from enslaved people from Africa to the Americas. Moving tens of millions, hundreds of millions from Europe to the New World and to Australia. These were giant demographic interventions on a scale that really staggers the mind. I mean, the hubris of it just completely staggers the mind, And in a way, that whole cycle is now sort of closing, because these demographic interventions were all state-sponsored. It was the major European states that sponsored them and controlled them and managed them. So, these kinds of flows of people were very closely managed once Europeans became the dominant powers in the world. So now what has happened is that with climate change, so many of these processes have sort of escaped state control. No state can actually control them. Because, it's not just climate change that is behind these huge movements. Technology plays a very important part in these movements. Communications technology plays a very large part in the movements of migrants. And really, the genie is out of the bottle. I mean, and perhaps never can be put back again. And this is, of course, deeply threatening, to governments everywhere, but most of all to European governments and Western governments, which have always taken it for granted that they have the right to, as it were, manage these demographic changes. And now suddenly we discover that these onrushes of people could actually completely destabilize our entire patterns of governance. And that's actually what's happened in both Europe and America. This anxiety about migration and the movement of people has really almost overwhelmed the traditional political systems of these regions.
Yeah, and also, in addition to climate change and communications, just the very fact of globalization that came from Europe and colonized and parasitized the economies of the colonial countries, thereby wrecking them.
That's right.
This is the blowback. These are the chickens coming home to roost, in some sense.
Yes, and in every sense. In a sense, what climate change is the result of is that we just thought everything was unlimited. For years we thought, we called this progress, making more and more cars, making more and more super yachts, making more and more of everything. And now suddenly we realize that actually they weren't free. We were borrowing them from the earth. And now the Earth is calling in its debts.
There's something else, though. I mean, this book is also one that has a deep sense of faith. I don't mean faith in the sense of, oh, I have faith that everything is going to work out just fine, but a kind of deeper faith of the redemption of the journey itself. The protagonist, your protagonist in the story, speaks about faith. And then there's these words at the center of a church in Venice, Santa Maria della Salute, which come up in this story, in this context. And those words are, from the origin, salvation comes. What does that mean? And what does it mean in the story as well?
Well, Santa Maria della Salute was really built in the aftermath of a terrible plague in the 17th century. And in many ways, the sort of the climate disruptions of the 17th century were so extreme that they reduced people around the world to these to utter desperation. And in Venice, what happened was that people began to appeal to Santa Maria della Salute, which means the Madonna of Good Health. And later, when the plague receded, they built this this incredibly beautiful basilica. It's sort of iconic of Venice, this great white building in the center of the city. And, you know, they placed these words right at the center because what they meant, really, is that it's from the womb, if you like, that salvation comes. The Virgin Mary, in this instance, standing in as a sort of symbol of the earth, if you like. So it's a very different way of thinking from, let's say, the techno-redemptionists of today. It's a completely blind and fanatical belief that somehow technology is going to redeem us from this. And unfortunately, you know, that technological mindset has its hands so firmly fastened on power that I don't know that we can ever shake them off. And they're going to take us ever deeper and deeper into this crisis.
And they want to live forever also.
They do, yes.
The human folly. But the book is one that has, there is redemption within this. Not techno-redemption, but redemption of the spirit, redemption of connection. Because I didn't find this book to be, you know, it would be so easy to have a novel about climate change be one that leaves you with utter despair, but this book actually did the opposite.
Yes, you might say that, you know, when people write books about climate change, they almost always end in dystopia and horror and so on. But, you know, I really draw a lot of, I don't know what you'd call it, hope or something like that, but I would say that I think we can only look to people who've already, as it were, experienced the end of the world. And those people are precisely the indigenous peoples of the Americas. And, you know, when you read a book like Black Elk Speaks, which talks about the ways in which these Lakota tribes were just systematically destroyed, and yet how they managed to cling to some kind of hopeful vision of the world, I think that's where we have to turn. I mean, if we're not going to turn to really destructive and horrific kinds of analogies.
And to find, maybe to find our faith, the root of it in the legends that remind us of what is really important.
That's exactly what Black Elk Speaks is about. I find that so wonderful that, you know, it's the legends of his tribe that really sustain him and the tribe in their moment of extremity.
Well, Amitav Ghosh, it has just been such a pleasure to talk with you about this wonderful novel, Gun Island. I highly recommend it to all my listeners. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It was a great pleasure to speak to you, and thank you for having me.
Amitav Ghosh. You can read an excerpt from Gun Island by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Aarti Shahani tells her family's immigration story. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Aarti Shahani is an exemplar of the immigration success story. She covers the biggest companies on earth for NPR from her base in Silicon Valley. But her road to success was paved through a devastating series of events that befell her family within a short period of time. Her father was arrested. Her family was charged with being connected to a notorious drug cartel, and deportations were piled on top of incarceration as punishment. Then September 11th happened, and Shahani found herself thrust into the role of advocate, not only for her family, but also for other Muslim immigrant families threatened by the new draconian policies of the Bush administration. Shahani has poured out this history onto the page in a gripping and surprisingly funny family memoir. Here we are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. I started out our conversation by asking Shahani to take us back before her family's troubles in America to the origins of her parents and their decision to come to the U.S. Tell us a bit about your parents, how they ended up coming to the U.S., and it wasn't their first migration either.
No, it was not their first rodeo. And this is something I think is really interesting about, you know, when you're trying to understand your own life's journey, how meaningful who your parents are and where they came from are to understanding yourself. You know, like it's just, we are so intrinsically connected. I found myself needing to ask my mom, why exactly did we come to America? Because, you know, she would always say this thing that a lot of immigrant parents say, like, we came here for a better life for you kids. And, you know, truth be told, when I was working on the memoir, Here We Are, I was actually at the beginning of the process working through a lot of resentment that I had. And so my question to mom was like, mom, I don't get it. You and dad were in Morocco. That's where my parents married. They were originally from the Indian subcontinent, but they landed in Morocco, effectively a stateless people after multiple migrations following the end of British colonial rule. They landed in Morocco. They had my brother, sister, and me. We were not desperately poor there. We were not fleeing a civil war there. And yet my parents chose to take the three kids, cross the Atlantic, come to America, and overstay visas and be undocumented. Mm-hmm. And so when mom would tell me, oh, we wanted a better life for you kids, my feeling was like, mom, we had a crappy life. What are you talking about? Like, I literally remember growing up, we lived in a roach den. I grew up more than once with a roach crawling on my bare skin. My parents had all sorts of legal problems even after we got our papers. And so I asked mom, why specifically did we move to America? Be specific about it. And then she opened up to me. And what she told me was apparently that back home, so to speak, in Casablanca, where I was born, my mom and dad were living in what's called a joint family. The joint family arrangement will be very familiar to people who I think are first and second generation immigrants from other countries. Basically, wife and husband live with husband's parents and brothers. It turns out my mom, living in the joint family, was for years, she was abused by my grandmother, my father's mother. What I mean by abuse is my grandmother would throw plates at my mom if she didn't like what was made for dinner. She would require that my mom ask permission before opening the refrigerator or stepping outside the house. My grandmother would not allow my parents to sleep together. So she ordered my dad to sleep in a room with her, and she ordered my mom to sleep in the living room floor. And that went on for years and years. And then something really terrible happened at home. And my mom, who is probably the most resilient human being I know, my mom attempted suicide. She attempted to take her own life. She swallowed pills. She was hoping to never wake up again. She did not successfully take her life. She did wake back up. I was born 9 months later. I was an accident. And then when my parents tried to bring me home from the hospital, my grandmother wouldn't let my mom in the house because I was a girl, and my grandmother didn't want another girl child because, you know, we're burdens on the family. She wanted a boy. And it was at that point that my father agreed to my mom's ongoing request, which is, let's just take our kids and come to America. Mm. And to me, it's, you know, it's so interesting because family structures can be so controlling. And a lot of the people who've come here to this country are women trying to flee not communism, but like patriarchy and a really controlling extended family, you know? And so in some ways, it's just so funny to me because I was talking to mom about this because I didn't know this about her. I'm incredibly close to her. I did not know what was the straw that broke the camel's back. I had no idea about it. And I joked with her. I was like, you know, mom, it's so funny because it's like, to some extent, crossing the Atlantic and overstaying visas and being undocumented, that was easier than attempting to go and live across the street from your mother-in-law, because that would not have been socially acceptable. Migrating was socially acceptable. Living outside of your in-law's home was not.
Yeah. And, you know, telling that story, and also so many other stories in this book, show the incredible complexity of people's lives coming into contact with a system which is not at all interested in the complexity of people's lives.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I mean, I just feel like the challenge with news coverage of specifically immigrants and immigration issues is it flattens us into these two-dimensional characters who you mainly only interrogate and scrutinize and see in the context of a legal proceeding or a policy debate. And I just feel like growing up in the family I did, the culture clash, the, you know, being married, like watching my parents be married, marriage is hard enough. Plenty of people see that, you know, throw moving across, you know, across the world to another country into it and just how differently people react to the culture. Like, you know, for mom, America was true freedom. She was like, oh my God, I can finally breathe. I can finally realize my potential. And for my dad, it was terrifying. He's like, what is this weird place where every cultural norm I have learned to be correct is being appended? You know, and that caused a lot of tension between them. I mean, part of what I write about in the earlier chapters of Here We Are is how, you know, even after my family got green cards, we got our papers and my father left. This is an untold part of the American story, but it happens actually pretty often. We got legal and dad was like, I don't want to be in this country. It's isolating. It's lonely. It's cold. There's winter. I've never seen snow before. I hate snow. And mom was like, no, I'm not leaving here. The kids and I are staying here. If you want to go, you can go, but I'm staying here. And my father actually picked up and left. He left the home. And the only reason he came back is one day when my mom was going grocery shopping and just trying to survive now as a single mom in the U.S. with the kids. She was like literally crossing the street, jaywalking, looking at her list, you know, like literally just asking herself, oh, can I really afford yogurt or juice this time? Or should I stick to like milk and eggs? Like just literally combing through that list and not realizing as she was jaywalking that a car was racing down and hit her and she ricocheted and her vertebrae was broken.
Right.
And, you know, I remember this as a child, my mom, not just the most resilient person I know, also physically incredibly fit, no longer able to stand up. She could not carry her own weight. She was in a wheelchair. She was in a neck brace. And at that point, my aunt, her little sister, the one who sponsored us to become legal in this country, called my dad. And she was just like, we need you to come back. Your family's not going to survive without you. And that's, it's funny because where the book takes off is really my father made the sacrifice of coming back here and being our breadwinner and our supporter, and then he ended up paying really dearly for it.
Exactly. And before we get to that, because I think that is really the heart of the story, in a way, you and your sister and brother are part of the American immigrant success story. I mean, you ended up going to one of the poshest private schools in Manhattan, Brearley, where you won a full scholarship.
Yeah, I was the scholarship kid at the Brearley School on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. You know, in current terms, the Brearley School costs a Tesla a year to attend. I mean, that's the kind of tuition you're talking about. And I remember going there and I didn't know people could be that rich. At the Brearley School, it was culture shock for me because first of all, I had never seen that many white people in one place in real life. I'd seen them on TV, but not in real life, because I grew up in a very multi-ethnic, working class, United Nations kind of neighborhood where people were from everywhere. And it really, like, so many blondes. I was like, oh my God, this is surreal. And then I learned really fascinating terms that I'd never heard before. You know, for example, a country house. A country house is a home that is not your first home. Do you understand how mind-blowing that is to a kid who grew up in Queens? Like, what are you talking about?
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Aarti Shahani about her terrific memoir, Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. And now let's talk a little bit about that American nightmare. Your father had a very hard time finding a job. So first talk about the impact of conditions that face new immigrants, no matter, you know, he had a successful business before coming here. He was a man who was clearly resourceful, knew many languages, and yet he could not get a job for a long time. So talk about the impact of conditions that face new immigrants and the stressors that that puts on families.
You know, America, it really challenges the newcomer, because what you hear about before you've come here is all of the opportunity. Oh my God, life is great here. But it's really selective information, because you're hearing it from a bunch of people who've made the biggest bet of their life and they need for it to pay off. And so they're not dispatching back home like, yeah, you're going to come here and work less than minimum wage and it's going to be hard. You know, you don't get that news. So my mom and dad came here, and, you know, my mom actually was able to find work, really decent work as a seamstress. She was already a seamstress before, and she started sewing wedding dresses and making roughly $20 an hour, which was amazing money back then. My father, however, you know, he spoke six languages, photographic memory, could multiply very large numbers in his head. I mean, he's just a brilliant guy. And had he been born into a different context, my father would have been one of the hedge fund managers or corporate types that I interview regularly for my day job. You know, like, he would have been one of those guys. But that's not what he was born into. He was born into a life of migration and irrelevance. So dad looked for work, and really all he got at the beginning was, you can sweep the streets, you can shovel the snow, you can go fetch us our lunch. That was what he was getting where he looked for work. Once we got our papers, though, dad was able to make a leap. He was actually able to start his own business on 28th Street and Broadway in Manhattan, and the exact same block where he used to shovel for, you know, $5 an hour. He made that leap, and it took him a decade to get there.
And he was successful at it.
Yeah, he was running a successful small store. You know, the business was basically selling watches and calculators in bulk. So this is before the days of Amazon, okay? This is before people are going online to buy. So even before really the days of big box retail, which really took off later in the 90s and 2000s. So, like, basically, customers would come to our store and they'd want to buy 1,000 or 2,000 or 10,000 Casio watches, let's say. And our business would sell, and it would be a very small margin. So sell them the watches, and then say the transaction makes you like 7%. You're selling in bulk, and you need to sell in bulk to, you know, pay the handful of workers who were there, to pay the rents, that kind of thing. But no, we were doing so well that dad managed to pay for the much vaunted move to New Jersey. We went to New Jersey against my will. I talk about it in the book as a brand crisis for me. Dad came home one day and he was like, we're moving to New Jersey. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I can't say I'm from Jersey. But he made us go to suburban New Jersey in a lovely colonial house. And, you know, we bought like a 5-foot television. We got a dog. I mean, we were totally living the dream. It was a nice couple of years.
And then he got caught up, but unbeknownst to him, in a criminal enterprise connected to the Cali cartel.
Yeah, the Cali drug cartel. One day, I get a call. My mom's calling me. My father is at Rikers Island Jail. He has been arrested. According to New York State, my dad, as well as his kid brother, my uncle, were selling watches and calculators to the wrong guys, to members of the cartel. It was very confusing. We go into court. I remember specifically missing a day at Brearley to go to court, the Queens County Criminal Courthouse. And that first hearing that I saw, it was surreal. You know, I wanted to be a prosecutor. I write about this and here we are. My goal when I was a kid was to become a prosecutor because I wanted justice and I wanted to put away bad guys. And I got to court and the state, the prosecutors, you know, the people versus Shahani. I was like, oh my God, we're not even the people anymore. And I was seething with rage and shame at my father. I'm like, Dad, what did you do? We're not the people anymore. You know, it's the people versus us now. And the prosecutors talked about how, just as they described my dad and uncle, they just made it sound like our store effectively existed as a front for the cartel, that our sole purpose was to clean dirty drug money. And, you know, they filed this litany of charges on an indictment. And then, interestingly, we blinked, and a few months later, as the case is sort of going on and there are hearings and more hearings, the state is offering a plea bargain. The defense lawyers we hired tell us, hey, they're offering you guys 8 months each. Just go in and do 8 months and put the matter behind you. And I remember thinking as a kid, if my family store is just a front for a cartel, why would they just be offered these kinds of short sentences? And then I also learned, by the way, about what's called the trial penalty. I didn't know about this before because the attorneys also told us, if you guys go to trial, however, if you're convicted, you're going to be punished for exercising your right to trial. You could face a decade. You could face longer than a decade inside. So what do you want to do, Mr. Shahani? You want to take the 8 months? You want to go and gamble? And so my father, as well as my uncle, they agreed to taking the plea. It's basically what everyone does. And I wasn't too involved in the case yet. Eventually, what I began talking about, and here we are, was, you know, the aspiring young prosecutor who's first hand at the law is basically becoming the faux defense attorney for my family. You know, it's at age 19 that I rolled up my sleeves and I just made the legal case and everything going wrong with it my cause. And what was going wrong with it is that after the 8 month sentences that each man, my dad and uncle, had agreed to, much to our surprise, much to the court's surprise, deportation was added as a second surprise punishment after they had served their time. And it was to our surprise because, you know, both men had what's called green cards, lawful permanent residence is the word on the card. And we all just thought of ourselves as American. You know, by this point, most of us had become naturalized citizens. It didn't make sense to us that you would serve your time for a mistake, that it would be a relatively low-level sentence, and your entire family could be here, even legally, and you would be automatically kicked out of the country. Like, that made no sense to us. And part of why it made no sense to us is because my family was at the front end of a new trend in America. In the 1990s, under President Bill Clinton, not under President Trump, under Clinton, the U.S. effectively created a mass deportation system that hadn't existed before. And part of what I'm recounting in this memoir is being a kid as a spectator, seeing that system applied to my family and being just utterly confused by it, you know, because, and this is something I just kind of explore, is there's such a disconnect between that law that mandates automatic lifelong expulsion, that law versus the culture that, you know, everything about American culture tells me, no, I belong here. This is my country. So, you know, you have to imagine as a 19-year-old how disorienting that is.
Yeah, you say it was a moment of truth, in fact. You say that life doesn't tend to change in a single moment, but in that moment, yours did, that you felt a complete metamorphosis. And, you know, just skipping down to the end of the paragraph, you said, and you knew deep in my bones, enough is enough. We've paid the price. This is my country. That means it must be my father's too.
That became the crux of the next decade of my life. I didn't know that it would be, but you know, now as a journalist, as a correspondent for NPR, I often interview people and I try to get that moment for the sake of storytelling, right? Like, for the sake of storytelling, we as storytellers look for the moments, the story you can pin something on. But like, genuinely, Francesca, like genuinely, my father called me on the phone because we actually had no idea about deportation coming along being the second punishment. My father called me on the phone weeping. I had never heard him cry before, weeping to tell me that this was going to happen. It was happening to his little brother and it was about to happen to him too. And I just remember like a bolt of electricity going through my body, utter disbelief. And I remember thinking and telling Dad, like, no, Dad, you're wrong. You have no idea what you're talking about. I know the Constitution. Double jeopardy is illegal. It's in the Constitution. There is no double jeopardy. And even like, you know, my sense of self, like the thought that my family could be tossed out of this country, I was like, on what slice of planet Earth would we make sense besides America? There is none. So I just remember that utter inability to accept what my father was telling me. No, 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 this must be a mistake. This must be a mistake. And then spending the next decade of my life realizing, no, it wasn't a mistake. This was real. And to not lose my family in this country, I would have to fight tooth and nail outside of the court system to keep him here.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Aarti Shahani about her memoir of immigration, Here We Are. So you became an advocate. I mean, first, when you had this realization, you decided to report the story as a journalist, which led to your uncovering a lot of the information that you needed to then actually become an advocate. You write that you were a new recruit to the Church of Public Witness, but journalists are supposed to be, quote, objective, unquote. And yet the other maxim that you hear as a journalist is that journalists give voice to the voiceless. How did you resolve this kind of tension between objectivity and giving voice to the voiceless?
My first career was not a journalist. It was an activist, a community organizer in New York City, where I was from, after September 11th. I was fighting for my dad. The 9/11 attacks happened. Suddenly, I was fighting for a whole lot of other people. What I observed about the news industry was journalists routinely took the government at their word, not questioning if, for example, I mean, like, you know, the weapons of mass destruction thing is a really obvious example of the deference the news industry gave to a set of sources that really needed to be interrogated more. But also the racism of the coverage that I saw, for example, when it was brown men who looked like my father being picked up, you saw the discomfort among journalists, the sort of sense of like, huh, this person is a suspected terrorist, without ever demanding the evidence for why this person is a suspected terrorist. This was the news coverage. It was taking skin color as the incriminating evidence, not requiring any additional information from the government. So I've never believed that journalism is objective, and I just saw it from the ground that it's not. That's just a farce that certain people, and fewer people, by the way, perpetuate about newsrooms. At our very best, newsrooms can be fair and rigorous. I take pride in being fair and rigorous. I believe that something I've done in my book is, you know, that this book is the most ambitious investigative project I've ever done. And I've done other investigative projects, interviewing over 100 people, collecting reams and reams of legal transcripts and files and combing through them to just reconstruct what was actually happening. I did with some degree of surgical precision, laying out what happened and then reflecting on how I felt about it, and knowing the difference between a set of facts versus the emotional journey. And I feel like people appreciate that. People appreciate when you can be so honest and so fair and even so quote unquote objective that you can even know the difference between what are a set of facts versus what are your feelings about them.
Yeah. And you also give voice to the voiceless in this.
I would hope so. You know, I wrote this memoir first and foremost, because I literally just could not keep living my life without writing it. I had an existential need to get this story out of me. And any writer would relate to that, that like you literally feel stuck until you've pushed it onto the page. It is a birthing process. Okay. That said, you know what makes me really happy is the number of people who've written me talking about how much they cried and laughed because they saw their own journey in it. You know, yes, my family's journey is a bit extreme. Not every migrant newcomer deals with, you know, charges of being wrapped up in the Cali cartel of Colombia. That said, the ups and downs of a highly risky life that requires cultural and economic adjustment I do hope that the book gives voice to the voiceless because, you know, our news industry has not.
One of the most interesting points that you make in this book is that so many people think that immigrants who have a criminal record are really to be dismissed, that they're not the ones, even by people in the immigration rights movement. You always want to talk about people who have no criminal record. And I think what your book shows is that having a criminal record doesn't necessarily mean you're a criminal.
You know, I think it's kind of like, for how long must you live with that label if you've ever had a run-in with the law? The criminal justice system is a really rampant part of the American experience for citizens and non-citizens, okay, especially people of color. It's, you know, I think it is the cancer of American culture that we have this system, as large and funded as it is. And I think the reality is there's a difference between polling data and headlines versus lived truth. In my experience, when I was campaigning to keep my father, the so-called criminal alien here, if I could get 3 or 5 minutes of someone's time to explain, hey, dad is the workaholic who was trying to support his family and he served his sentence. And by the way, the judge thought he should never even spend a day in jail, but the prosecutor insisted on it. And we're all good people and we're just trying to get our lives back together. If I could just get that sliver of time in front of someone, they would typically be on our side. I mean, I got hundreds of letters of support to keep my father in this country. And it's either the political support I mounted, including, by the way, a Republican congressman. I think that there's just a huge difference between how people actually feel when you talk to them versus what polling data will tell you. And this, you know, we see it playing out not just in the small scale life of my family, but in American politics, the huge gap between what we say people feel and then what they actually feel when we talk to them. You know, that's happening all over the place, across issues, across constituencies.
Yeah, and one of those issues is the idea of abolishing ICE. I think many people probably don't realize that ICE is not something that's been around as long as, say, the Department of Education. And AOC and others have called for abolishing it. What is your thought about that and about, you know, what is the right way to talk to people about ICE?
Here's my issue with how immigration is currently being done in our nation of immigrants. There is literally no line to stand on for the vast majority of people who are trying to get their papers and get adjusted in this country. People say, stand online. Well, why won't they stand online? Where's the line? The lines don't exist anymore. You know, my book, it's called Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares. If my family arrived today as opposed to the 80s, it would just be nightmares. The thing that is miraculous about this country, the ability to leap to places you could never have imagined you could leap, we're killing that without letting newcomers be part of us. So there's no line. And then meanwhile, what you have is a incredibly well-funded mass deportation system where basically prosecutors have all the power and there's no due process. So, you know, like, ICE is an agency, it's a prosecutorial agency that has very few limits by law on its power. So it's exercising the power it's been given. That shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. And I think that the fact of this system being so out of whack, starting in the 1990s, not today, it's just like a recent piece of American history that we'd all be better off knowing, because then we could have a real conversation about, like, okay, so how do our policymakers make sure that the American dream is still possible? I don't see the immigration problem as the failure of immigrants to get their papers when there isn't a way to do it. I see our immigration problem as a failure of politicians to make the laws reflect our culture.
Well, that's a beautiful way to put it and very powerful. Just as your memoir, Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares, is so powerful. Aarti Shahani, thank you so much for this terrific conversation.
I love talking with you. Thank you very much.
Aarti Shahani. To read an excerpt from Here We Are, go to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.